Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'm going to give two lectures, as you know, and the whole idea here, because this retreat is about science and faith, is that the purpose of this lecture is to try to convince you that I actually am a real scientist, because the lecture tomorrow night or tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to tell you about my faith journey. And it's not as meaningful unless you think that, hey, this is, you know, a scientist just like all the other scientists. So that's what I'm going to do. So I'm going to show lots of slides. Tomorrow, it's going to be more of a testimonial. The slides are going to be for decoration purposes, and there will be handouts. So the style will be very, very different. And Professor Oberg and I have not coordinated, so I have no idea what she's going to talk about, but if she talks about what I was going to talk about tomorrow, then we're in trouble because I don't know what else to do. So we'll see what happens, but it'll all be good. So let me start with my biography. I was born 65 years ago in New York City, and I think that must be a wagon. I'm going to figure out what that is. But from the time that I was very little, I was interested in astronomy. I had kids' books on astronomy. There was a record called A Child's Introduction to Outer Space. A record is like a CD or a DVD, but bigger. And I used to play that over and over again until it broke into two pieces. And however, I lived in New York City. So even though I was interested in space and astronomy, you couldn't see the stars. It's very much like out here. So fortunately, for the first 6 years of my life, we lived in Manhattan, six blocks from the American Museum of Natural History, Hayden Planetarium, which today looks completely different from this structure here. It's now this sort of giant glass thing. But back then, it was, I thought, a very distinguished, beautiful building. And in that building was one of the world's best optical projectors, a Zeiss projector that displayed the stars on the ceiling, and an astronomer would lecture. And it was really a magical experience. And so you could learn about the sky that way with these beautiful planetarium programs. And I have to say that people don't go to planetaria as much as they used to, and it's really a wonderful experience. So if you are near a planetarium, I strongly recommend it, especially if it's a big one. So as I grew up from the 1960s, the other thing that was happening was that the U.S. and the Soviet Union were in this race, this space race, to try to get to the moon first. And the U.S. beat the Soviet Union on that. There was a lot of discussion, well, did the Soviets really want to go to the moon, or was this kind of cooked up by President Kennedy and then Johnson? And yes, they did. And there's actually hardware, which after the Soviet Union fell, Western engineers could go and look at, that was built for the purpose of putting a cosmonaut, a Russian astronaut, on the moon. But when the moon landings occurred, I was a real fan. And everyone remembers Apollo 11, first moon landing, but most people don't remember the others. And of course, the TV networks pretty much gave up on it after Apollo 12 and then picked it up again with Apollo 13 because the astronauts nearly died. And then after that, they forgot about it again. But cable TV was coming into being in the early 1970s. And so they really didn't have anything to show. There were no cable shows. So they played the moon landings straight out. And by the time of the later Apollo missions, the astronauts were walking on the moon, collecting rock samples for up to 24 hours, three spacewalks, three moonwalks of 8 hours each. So as a kid, I could order these books from NASA. This is On the Moon with Apollo 16, and they had these very detailed tables of where the astronauts were going with their rovers and what samples they were going to collect. And I would sit up middle of the night watching cable TV and watching the astronauts do this. And it was really, for me, it was kind of fun. And it was a big blow to me when the Apollo program ended, because I fully expected to be going to Mars in my 20s. So this is when I was 13 or 14 years old. Okay, there we go. My father, who owned a clothing store in New York, passed away in 1973 in his 40s. He was an alcoholic and also abused pills. It was a big blow to our family. You'll notice that his stone there has Hebrew writing, and as I'll talk about tomorrow, I was raised in a Jewish household. I was Jewish before I converted to Catholicism. So this was a very, I would say, seminal moment in my life, because I felt very vulnerable. There was, financial issues associated with my father's death and so on. And I'll talk a little bit more about what happened after that. So welcome. You guys, there's one seat over there. That way you'll be able to see the screen. And there's a seat in the back, too. You able to see the screen?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Great. Excellent. Okay. So around this time, I found a book which was written by an astronomer at Cornell University named Carl Sagan, who became very, very famous about 7 years later in 1980 with a TV series that he produced called The Cosmos. And the TV series was very, very famous. Now, I recognize that in this generation, Carl Sagan is not as well recognized, not as famous as Beyoncé, but how many of you have heard of Carl Sagan? Okay, educated audience. So this was his first book, 1973, and I fell in love with this book. It essentially described a kind of a vision of the scientist as a pioneer who would help humankind essentially go out into the cosmos, become a spacefaring species. It was a very optimistic book. And I not only read that book to myself, but I was so thrilled with it that I would read passages out loud in our apartment. My sister, who was 4 years younger than I am, would disappear somewhere. My mother finally, I think, fed up with my readings of these passages, said, "Why don't you write to Professor Sagan?" And I said, "You're kidding me. He'll never respond, right? This great Cornell University professor, Ivy League professor." And she said, "Write to him." So I did. And he wrote back. In fact, I wrote a letter to him asking how I could become an astronomer. And here is the letter from 1974, in which he describes what to study. I was in high school by that point, what to study and how to become an astronomer. And I was thrilled with this letter, absolutely thrilled. So he said, "I think your dedication to astronomy is admirable and should be encouraged." So with this letter, you would think my course was set, that was it. But it actually wasn't. I took a deviation in my career aspirations at that point. And that deviation occurred because of the economy, which is encapsulated in this figure. So this is a graph showing the research and development public funding in the United States in billions of dollars. So this is $80 billion. All reference to 2019, so inflation is taken out of this, versus year, up to about 2020. So I haven't tried to update this graph, but the point is really in the 1970s. So if you see here health in blue, space in yellow, energy in green, everything else, general science, you'll notice something particularly about, and these are sort of cumulative, you'll notice something about space. That space, beginning in the 1960s, was sort of nothing and grew to be this enormous public expenditure in the mid to late 1960s. So what was that? It was the effort to put U.S. astronauts on the moon. In fact, the NASA budget became something on the order of 5 or 6% of the total federal budget. Today, it's somewhere less than 0.1% of the federal budget. So this is where I was getting all excited. Hayden Planetarium, people, you know, humans landing on the moon, all this stuff. Here's where Carl Sagan responded to me. And if you ignore all of this, because you can't predict the future, it looked like expenditures in space were just going to go down, that space was something that would disappear as a national endeavor. What was going on at that time? The economy was terrible. The Vietnam War was sapping our national wealth. And there was also, we had a presidential administration that was not interested in continuing the space program. So, bottom line is, I chickened out at that point and decided I would become a medical doctor instead. Now, you'll notice that here in the 1980s, things get even worse, right? So they start to go up again. Here's where I went to graduate school, and then they take a nosedive in the mid-1980s, and I'll talk about that time in a few minutes. But this was serious enough. So I decided I was going to be a medical doctor, that I could get, have a good career, make a lot of money, and I volunteered at a hospital to work with a cancer doctor to do grafts for her and things like that. So then my pediatrician, who happened to be a Cornell alum, sent me a letter and said that there was a talk in downtown New York City by another Cornell professor named Frank Drake, who was a radio astronomer, and would I like to go to that talk. So I said yes, and he didn't go. My mother didn't go. By that point, I was junior or senior in high school, so I went downtown, and it was a talk all about the great Arecibo Radio Observatory and all of the astronomical discoveries that were being made. The telescope in 1974 had been refurbished and had been made much more sensitive. And the bottom line, after listening to this public lecture, I remember coming down in the elevator thinking to myself, I do not want to be a medical doctor. I really want to be an astronomer. So it was Carl Sagan who inspired me and Frank Drake who rescued countless individuals from the inevitable malpractice that would have arisen had I become a medical doctor. And possibly my pediatrician sensed that, and that's why he had me attend this talk. So decades later, I was a high school student, so I was too timid to go up to Professor Drake after the end of the talk and say, oh, Professor Drake, you inspired me. But decades later, I could do that, and here I am with him in 2013 at the 50th anniversary of the Arecibo Radio Telescope, and I did tell him that story, and he was obviously very, very flattered. So I did end up majoring in astronomy. So in the late 1970s, I went to the University of Rochester. My mother had remarried. She married a chemist, industrial chemist from Australia. And I was physics and astronomy major at the University of Rochester. I did get into Cornell, but we couldn't afford it. So I got a good scholarship at Rochester, which is a great university in upstate New York. My senior thesis advisor was Hugh Van Horn, who was a superb teacher. He actually got his PhD at Cornell. And right around my junior year of college, when I was thinking about what kind of astronomy I wanted to do, this issue of Sky and Telescope arrived in my mailbox. It's a magazine for amateur astronomers, and I subscribed to it since high school. And the March 1979 issue, which actually this is not the original one I had, a graduate student of mine, when he heard this story, found a copy on eBay and got it for me. But this is what the cover looked like. And it's a picture of Jupiter. And it's a picture of Jupiter taken by the Voyager 1 spacecraft as it honed in on the Jupiter system. The very first real flyby with substantial instruments. There were two other spacecraft, the Pioneer spacecraft, but they weren't well instrumented. But Voyager had excellent cameras. The picture that it took of Jupiter, even months out from the encounter, was much better than anything you could do with telescopes of the time, Earth-based telescopes. So when I saw this picture, I thought, I want to be a planetary astronomer. I want to be a planetary scientist. I want to work on planets. I want to work on space missions. I want to work on Voyager. So Hugh Van Horn, who was a stellar astronomer, was very, very helpful. Although he wasn't a planetary scientist himself, he knew of an up-and-coming planetary scientist who had also gotten his PhD at Cornell, but about 10 years after Van Horn, and was just starting a professorial career in Los Angeles, and that was David Stevenson. So Hugh contacted Dave, still a little too early for email. I think he called him up, possibly. And I ended up applying to a number of grad schools and decided to go to Caltech because of this opportunity. So I became a graduate student at Caltech in Pasadena in 1980. And that's Dave Stevenson around that time, a little few years after that. And as a graduate student, I worked on a number of projects, and being a graduate student had its ups and downs. I'm kind of glossing over all of the torture, like the qualifying exam and so forth. Are there any graduate students in the audience here? Okay. Oh, quasi-grad student. Okay. So anyway, it's the first few years are really stressful, and you know, you've graduated college, and now you're a graduate student, and you think you've got it made, you know, this, you got into this school, they're paying you a salary, and then all of a sudden you have to face these qualifying exams, and they're kind of terrifying, and there's tendency to, you know, feel like you're being torn down. But Dave was very supportive, and I got my PhD with him. One of the things I did in my dissertation was to work on a project based on Voyager data, that same spacecraft that had flown by Jupiter, flew past Saturn in 1980, a year after it flew by Jupiter, and Voyager 2 followed a year after that. And Saturn has a moon called Titan, which is unique in having a very dense atmosphere. In fact, the air at the surface of Titan is 4 times denser than the air in this room. And the reason that it is stable on a body that is not much larger than the planet Mercury and less massive than Mercury is that it's so cold. Saturn is 10 times farther from the sun than the Earth is, so it gets 100 times less sunlight. It's really 9 times, so it's 81, 9 squared. And so the surface is very cold. And instead of water flowing on the surface and water forming clouds, it's methane, CH4, that does all of that on Titan. So it's a very fascinating place. Voyager revealed a little bit of that. We tried to address what the source of the methane might be, and we ended up publishing a paper in Science along with another Caltech professor, Yuk Jung, and it had got a lot of notoriety. So that notoriety got me launched on a career of working on spacecraft missions. But it was also the generosity of Dave that made that possible. So Dave is now a professor emeritus. He's still doing work, but he's officially retired from teaching. So after we wrote this paper and the Voyager 1 and 2 flybys had happened and they were over with, scientists from the U.S. and Europe put their heads together and said, you know, the Saturn system is a really cool place. We want to go back there. And so there were discussions with people at NASA headquarters and the European Space Agency headquarters. And there was a committee formed of scientists from the U.S. and Europe to look at what might be done after Voyager in the outer solar system. So this international U.S. and European scientists came to JPL. And JPL is the NASA facility that actually designed and built and operated and operates still today, the Voyager spacecraft. So, as Father said, it's operated by Caltech, but it's a NASA facility. And it's a little different from a NASA Civil Service Center, which is a good thing right now. And I can describe the difference to you in the question and answer period. So they came to JPL and they asked Dave Stevenson to give them a talk on the current state of knowledge of Titan surface, because that was one thing that was of great interest, and how can we find a way to go to Titan surface and see what's really there. The moon has this hazy atmosphere, so you can't really see the surface. You can sense it at certain wavelengths. So Dave could have easily said, sure. But instead, what he said was, why don't you ask my graduate student, Jonathan Lanin, to give the talk? And that got me, I got to meet these scientists. They got to hear me talk. That got me invited to other conferences. And that got me into various studies that led to the Cassini mission, which we'll hear about a little bit later. So lesson number one is, if you are a professor or another research supervisor, be generous and let your students give the talk if they're ready to do that. So that was great. So I got my PhD, and I then went on to a postdoc position at the University of Arizona with Don Hunton, who you see there at the top. Angeletta Corradini was one of those scientists in that international group that came to JPL. And she invited me to a conference in Italy that turned out to be very important for what would become the Cassini mission. And we became very good friends, and I did several sabbaticals there. And then Charles Alacci, who's retired now, was the director of JPL for many, many years. And JPL is there in an aerial view in the lower right. And he organized a group to think about ways to see the surface of Titan, this mysterious moon of Saturn. And he's a radar scientist, a radar engineer, really. And so, of course, he thought about radar, and he convened this group to figure out how to use a radar system to probe the surface of Titan, which eventually did end up on Cassini. So I got involved in all of that. And in the interim, I also was offered a faculty position at the University of Arizona. I show you this letter because the salary was, at the time, 1986, $29,000, which sounds like a very small amount of money, but if you inflate it to today, it actually is not too bad a salary. The interesting thing, though, is that today, when we offer early career scientists faculty positions, especially in astronomy, they ask for a lot of startup money. They ask for money for their laboratories, for fancy computers. And it can total $1 million, actually, which makes faculty in astronomy very expensive. But my startup package was a guarantee of my first year's summer salary, because universities, you get your academic year salary, you need to raise your summer salary from research funds. Money to cover telephones and copying, that all sounds very quaint, $2,000. A personal computer, an IBM PC-AT. Does anyone know what a PC-AT looked like? Yeah, it looked sort of like a small air purifier with a TV on the top. And it would go, and you put these disks in that would have store maybe 10 kilobytes of data, and that was a computer. So that was, you know, that was all. And out of that, I made a career because my career was based on working with NASA missions. During that time, I got married to Cynthia Ewing. We got married in 1987 in a Methodist church. I'll talk about that next time. And there's my stepfather over on her right and my sister on my left. And we've been married, Cynthia and I, now for 37 years. 37 years, a bit. And then, thanks to this little boost I got from my thesis advisor and the work that I was doing on how to get information on the surface of Titan from potentially instruments on another spacecraft, I ended up being selected for a mission to Saturn and Titan called the Cassini-Huygens mission. The Cassini spacecraft was built by JPL. It did orbit Saturn and was filled with all sorts of instruments, and it used Titan's gravity to swing to different parts of the Saturn system, to the different moons, to the rings, and so forth. And then the Huygens probe, which was named after the Dutch optical scientist, Christiane Huygens. Cassini was named after Gian-Domenico Cassini, French-Italian scientist who really discovered the nature of the rings. So Huygens was a saucer-shaped thing about 10 feet across with five instruments that was dropped off by Cassini, fell through the atmosphere of Titan, and landed on the surface. And so in 1989, 1990, a bunch of us wrote proposals to NASA and ESA. I was selected as an interdisciplinary scientist, and that really was, for me, the turning point for my career. That was the thing that I did for over 25 years and was really probably the biggest aspect of my career. So I started out at Caltech. I went to the University of Arizona in Tucson. I then, after 26 years at the University of Arizona, did a two-year leave of absence and taught at the University of Rome after working with Angeletta Corradini for quite a long time. My wife and I thought we might stay there. This was 2010, 2011. But in the meantime, Cornell lost a very prominent planetary scientist named Jim Bell, who went to Arizona State University. They are the Sun Devils. And so Cornell recruited me from Arizona and Tor Vergata. So in 2011, I went to Cornell and I taught there for 13 years. And then at the age of 65, there was the opportunity to go to Caltech again and JPL. And so I ended up back at Caltech. So that's kind of a slightly unusual career, I suppose, ending up after 40 years at the place where you did your PhD work, but it's certainly been a fun journey, and I feel very blessed to have been able to do that. So here I am in my office at JPL, and it looks very beautiful outside, but just below that window there's a loading dock and a set of dumpsters, so at 4 o'clock every day these garbage trucks come along and empty the garbage. But other than that, it's a great office. That is Mars on my computer screen from the Curiosity rover, also built at JPL. And I'm happy during the question period to talk about what I do as a chief scientist. But that's the end of my biography. I want to talk about some of these missions, and then I'll close. I want to talk about them because they're interesting. They're really cool. So the first mission, and I was only involved in a subset of NASA missions, and those are the ones I'm going to talk about. So Voyager Neptune was the culmination of this grand odyssey of the Voyager spacecraft through the outer solar system. Voyagers 1 and 2 went past Jupiter in 1979, Saturn in 80 and 81, and then Voyager 1, because it had flown by Titan, was kicked off on a trajectory that didn't pass close to any of the other bodies in the outer solar system, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. But Voyager 2 did go on to Uranus in 1986 and Neptune in 1989. By that point, I was a professor at Arizona. And I was asked by one of the other faculty at Arizona, who was the principal investigator for an instrument on Voyager, an instrument that breaks apart ultraviolet light into its components that you can see what the composition of the atmosphere of some of these objects is. He asked me to be the champion for the ultraviolet spectrometer for the Voyager Neptune mission. And the reason for that is that this moon of Neptune, so here's Neptune, very blue. Here's Triton, which is this moon of Neptune. Triton is 30 times farther from the sun than the Earth is, Neptune and Triton. Three times farther from us than Saturn is, and so very little was known about it. And in fact, Triton was, its size was not known. So when it came time to plan this mission, this last flyby in the outer solar system, the grand finale of the Voyager Odyssey, there was a lot of discussion about what to do at Triton. And there were two different techniques to use. One is using the ultraviolet spectrometer to probe the upper atmosphere, and the other is to use the radio system to probe the lower atmosphere of Triton, called a radio occultation. And the size of Triton, that it was thought to be at the time, 1988-89, and the accuracy of the navigation that the JPL navigators could provide meant that you can only do one or the other, not both, even though you should do both. So there was a big argument about this, and the Voyager project scientist, Ed Stone, convened the science panel to decide which should be done. And so Lyle Broadfoot asked me to be the champion for the ultraviolet spectrometer. And so I got to meet Ed Stone, who's kind of a legend at JPL. He died a year and a half ago now at the age of almost 90. And he was the Voyager project scientist for many, many decades, because even after this flyby, Voyager 1 and 2 continued to probe interplanetary space and the magnetic field of the region of magnetic influence of the sun, and continues to do that today. In fact, it's beyond that region of influence of the sun. It's beyond the heliosphere and what you can think of as interstellar space. So he was really masterful at holding a debate, making scientists feel like winners, whichever side they were on. And I got to participate in that. So that was my first experience with the space mission. It's in 1989, a little bit before being selected for Cassini. Okay, so Cassini, I'm just going to show you a video that gives highlights of the first 4 years of this mission. It was produced by JPL, and you'll hear a familiar voice. And I might turn the lights off so we can see it. It's about 2 minutes long. Sorry about that. Oh, there we go. Sorry about that. Here we go. That the dark areas, and perhaps even most of the surface of Titan, is in fact covered with organic material.
I looked so young.
Scientists got interviewed for various videos and things, but of course I had to show you the one that I was looking for. So anyway, but it was an amazing mission. It did discover that there were these lakes and seas of methane and ethane on the surface of Titan. That discovery was mostly from that radar system that Charles Alacci had convened this group back in the mid-80s to kind of figure out how to do that, and it was just an amazing odyssey. That was done after the first 4 years in 2008, but Cassini continued to return data to 2017 until it basically ran out of gas and had to be destroyed in Saturn's atmosphere so it wouldn't accidentally land on one of the moons that might possibly have biological activity and contaminate it.
So then Juno at Jupiter is a mission that I'm involved in now. It's another JPL mission. It's one where a group of scientists wrote a proposal, and it was there were different missions competed by NASA against each other, and this was selected in 2003. It was launched in 2011, arrived in 2016, and is still there. This is very exaggerated color. This is not what Jupiter looks like, but the features that you see are really there. And so Jupiter's atmosphere is this amazing kind of Van Gogh-like atmosphere full of storms and swirls and eddies and so on. And very recently, Juno flew past Jupiter's moon Io, which is the most volcanically active moon in the volcanically active body in the solar system. It's tugged and squeezed by Jupiter's gravity because it's in a non-circular orbit. And there are two cameras on Juno. One is called JunoCam, which took relatively distant pictures. And then this engineering instrument called the SRU, or Stellar Reference Unit, took some pictures when Io, on the part of Io that was actually shadowed from the sun. So this is the night side, except that it's partially illuminated by Jupiter. And by taking low-light pictures, you can actually see these features, which are hot lava coming up in cracks on the surface of this moon. So it's a pretty amazing place. The scientist in charge of JunoCam is Candace Hansen, and in charge of the SRU is Heidi Becker at JPL. And that's been an exciting and fun mission, too. So now Europa Clipper. And this is the last one I'm going to talk about. Europa Clipper is a mission to an ocean world. And one of the cool things I've been able to do at JPL is, although I've been involved in the mission for a long time, I was able to, with my JPL badge, drive onto the Kennedy Space Center and just drive up to the launch pad the day before the launch, which was totally cool. Right? I've never been that close to a real rocket. And then my wife was supposed to join me for the launch, but there was a hurricane a couple of days before. Her flights got screwed up. There were no seats. So she said, take a selfie during the liftoff. And I said, what do you mean take a selfie? She said, take a selfie. So I rehearsed it, and it actually came out. Okay? So not bad. One of my great So why do we care about Europa? We care about Europa because it's one of the moons of the outer solar system that appears to have liquid water under its surface and therefore could have biology. So there are a number of these moons. The amount of liquid water that's inside Europa could actually be twice the amount of water in all of the oceans on the Earth's surface and the crust of the Earth. Even though Europa is only the size of the Earth's moon. It's mostly a rocky body. We know that from its density, its mass divided by its volume. But it has this outer shell of water, and initially it was thought that that outer shell might just be ice, but it turns out to be ice on top and liquid water on the bottom. So one of the ways we know that is thanks to Jupiter's magnetic field, which is tilted relative to the rotation axis of Jupiter. So it's a little hard to see this diagram, but you can see the field lines of the magnetic field bobbing up and down relative to the orbit of Europa, which is aligned with Jupiter's rotation axis. And so as a consequence of that, if you follow a field line of Jupiter, the one that connects to Europa, you find that it bobs up and down. And therefore, the magnetic field that Europa experiences varies in time. And because it varies in time, if there's a conductor inside of Europa, then that time-varying magnetic field, if you've taken some physics, will create eddy currents, which then generate an induced magnetic field. And the spacecraft Galileo, which I was not involved in, but another JPL spacecraft, which orbited Jupiter in the mid-1990s, detected with its magnetometer that induced magnetic field multiple times. And that's the evidence for this liquid water layer. In fact, that induced field is so strong that the liquid water layer has to be most of the ice volume of this moon, with the silicate, the rocky part, being most of the bulk of Europa. But this could extend between 100 to 200 kilometers down, and if you total up all that water, it's twice what we have in the Earth's ocean. So it's really amazing. You could put very big whales in there if there's organics for them to feed on. But the surface is totally uninhabitable because Jupiter's powerful magnetic field, which allowed the ocean to be detected in the first place, also shoots particles, electrons, protons, and heavier nuclei at the surfaces of these moons and makes them radiation death traps. So there is hint of surface activity in the ice. There are these nice fractures. When Juno flew by Europa a couple of years ago, it saw features like this double ridge here with dark smudges on either side. And the Galileo spacecraft saw that on other parts of Jupiter. And those might be places where organic molecules are coming out onto the surface and being darkened by the radiation that impinges on the surface of Europa. But we don't know if that's the case because Galileo didn't carry the right kind of instruments. It had a damaged antenna. It couldn't really return very much data on the composition. The Juno spectrometer also didn't tell us very much about the composition. Now, there is some ground-based data coming from, or I should say Earth-based data, coming from Hubble Space Telescope and the James Webb Space Telescope that identifies sodium chloride salt, and it's localized in the places on Europa that are most heavily fractured, and carbon dioxide ice also in those heavily fractured areas, which are outlined in the black here. And that suggests that ocean material is coming up in these places where it's easiest to come up, in these thin crust fractured areas. But again, until we send a really good spectrometer there, we won't know. And so one of the purposes of Europa Clipper is to map the composition of the surface of Europa and tell us whether those dark smudges are indeed organic molecules, whether there are other kinds of salts present besides sodium chloride, and so whether the ocean might have the right ingredients to be able to support life. Is there the kind of organic chemistry that would be needed for primitive microbes to exist there? Samantha was an undergrad at Cornell, then she went to Caltech's grad student, then she was my postdoc in the last few years that I was at Cornell, and now she's a faculty member. And Geronimo is at Goddard Space Flight Center. So there's the spacecraft, and it's on its way now to Europa, and will arrive in 2030, and hopefully will tell us whether the ocean has organic carbon-bearing molecules. I did have Beyond in my talk, and so the Beyond part is the James Webb Space Telescope, which is not a JPL project. It's a Goddard Space Flight Center project. NASA Goddard is very close to here in Greenbelt, Maryland, and that was a project I got involved in. It has taken spectacular pictures of galaxies, but my involvement has been more for the solar system and also for planets around other stars. So that's just a sort of a little potpourri of the things I've been involved in. I have not been involved directly in Mars sample return, but Mars sample return is the next big, hopefully, project that JPL will do. JPL sent two very complex rovers to the surface of Mars, Curiosity and Perseverance. Perseverance, which is shown up here, it takes selfies, by the way, carried a helicopter called Ingenuity that flew around in this very thin atmosphere and actually flew 70 times and helped to pick out sampling sites. And this is a dried up riverbed. This is a dried up riverbed going into the crater that Perseverance landed in. And there's a big delta feature, deposits that you would expect at the end of a river where sediments were dumped out into the western end of the crater. So Perseverance has been sampling all of that material, and it puts them in these sample tubes, which are this size. And so the sample itself, This is a 3D printed plastic model, but the sample is cored, it's drilled, and so it's sort of this size of rock and soil, and Perseverance loads this into this and seals it up. And there are 40 of these tubes, and 28 have been filled. And now the problem is getting them back to Earth. So the project to get them back to Earth with a lander and a retrieval orbiter and all that was being worked on by JPL. The costs went up in 2023 or 24. Project was stopped, and now we're waiting to see if the new NASA administration will allow JPL to get the samples back. So stay tuned. All right. This is a future mission to Uranus that I'm not going to talk about, but it's the next natural step in exploring the outer solar system. U.S. has orbited Jupiter. The U.S. with Europe has orbited Saturn through Cassini. Next step is to go to Uranus or Neptune, very mysterious worlds that Voyager only caught a glimpse of. So I want to close and leave plenty of time for questions. This is another James Webb Space Telescope image. It's really an amazing facility. We can talk about it over the next day or so. I tried to figure out what the right quote is to end with, because I feel this tremendous sense of gratitude to God for allowing me a life that has had so many great adventures. You know, when you're in the middle of these things and stuff isn't working or something gets canceled or there's no money or someone calls you up and complains, it's very easy to think, why did I get involved in this? But the big picture is it's been a tremendous race. And so what I actually picked was from the Book of Tobit. Because we should all in our careers seek counsel from wise people and take good advice, and in everything we do, bless the Lord our God, and ask Him to make all our paths straight, because He's the only one who can do that for us. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.